a guess. I have to say I think that might be it, but it's a guess and I'm not sure. Okay, that explains to you the Coriolis effect, to try to explain why the rotation causes this appearance of belts and zones, that is a bright and dark stripe. Suppose that I am standing at the equator of the Earth, and you are up here in Bloomfield Hills, roughly halfway from the equator to the pole. And I take a ball and I throw it due north up to you. We carefully ignore for this presentation the fact that I cannot throw a ball that hard, that if I could, it would be destroyed by air friction and some of my hand, and little details like that. And we assume that I'm throwing this ball up to you due north. Well, when the ball leaves my hand, it has a northward component of speed, of velocity, right? Because I've given it to it. I've thrown it due north. But it also is traveling eastward because the planet is rotating. In fact, it has an eastward component of velocity of about 1,000 miles an hour, because that is the speed that I, standing on the equator, holding the ball, had at the moment the ball left my hand. As it travels northward, up towards you, it still keeps going eastward at 1,000 miles an hour. Why not? Nothing is falling down, right? We're assuming no air friction. And so, it keeps going eastward at 1,000 miles an hour, but the ground under it is going eastward less and less rapidly the farther away from the equator it goes, because of this effect where we're getting closer to the pole. So by the time it reaches you, the ground where you are is traveling eastward only at 700 miles an hour, but the ball is still going eastward at 1,000 miles an hour. What seems to you to have happened is that some mysterious force has grabbed the ball and deflected it eastward of you. Okay? And so in fact, to get it to you, I should have thrown it towards some position that was west of where you were, so that by the time the ball got to you, it would have caught up with you. Likewise, if you throw the ball at me, southward, toward the equator, it's coming south, and it has an eastward component velocity of 750 miles an hour, because that's the speed that was traveling to reach your hand. That's just 704, sorry, it's not 750. But by the time it reaches me at the equator, well, the ground under, the ground where I am, is traveling eastward 1,000 miles an hour, and so to me it looks as though some mysterious force is making the ball veer westward, away from it. Okay, that is called the Coriolis effect, after the scientist who first explained it, sometimes 1700s, 1800s, I'm not too good on that history. It's sometimes incorrectly called the Coriolis force, but there's not really a force involved. There's not really a force of grabbing the ball and deflecting it eastward or westward. It's just that it looks that way if you're standing on a rotating Earth and obstinately refusing to admit the fact that you are rotating, right? That you are moving eastward. Well, on a planet like Jupiter, the Coriolis effect is going to be absolutely enormous. Now, couple that with convection. I explained convection last week, right? I did? Okay. The problem is when you give a whole lot of lectures, you have to be very, very careful to make absolutely sure that you have said to a given audience what you think you've said. And if I ever started explaining something I've already gone through, for heaven's sake, stop me. I don't do that very often, but I've been known to do it on occasion. Well, okay, so you have convection. Well, here is a region in Jupiter's atmosphere where there's a convection cell, that is to say, material coming up and then wanting to reaching a certain height and falling back down. Convection of air very often has the effect of forming clouds. And the reason for it is that as the air goes up, of course, it expands and therefore cools. Right? Things expand when they're cool and contract when they're hot. It expands and therefore cools. And the effect of the cooling, the fact that it's getting hot to a I'm sorry, the expansion is totally relevant, forget that. As it goes up to a higher height, it gets colder. That's the point I'm trying to make. There may be some substance within it, which is gaseous at a certain temperature down here, and suddenly turns liquid or solid when you reach a certain critical temperature. And if so, that substance will form a cloud. It may be several such substances, which means you may have different clouds made of different materials at different heights, and indeed, as I said, we think that's the case for Jupiter. Highest clouds are frozen ammonia, then you have a clear air region, then you have a region of clouds of frozen ammonium hydrosulfide, then you have clear air, then you have a region of clouds of frozen water, and then maybe clear air, and then liquid water, and there may even be a region at the very bottom where there is one of the clouds made of ammonia dissolved in water. And by the way, those of you who are familiar with so-called household ammonia is a gas. So-called household ammonia is ammonia gas dissolved in water. It is not actually ammonia. It's ammonium hydrosulfide, which is ammonia gas ammonium hydroxide, which is ammonia gas dissolved in water. All right. That is convection cell. The material goes up, suddenly forms clouds when the temperature becomes right. But the effect of the cloud formation releases heat, and that has the effect of stopping the convection, stopping the upward motion. So it stops further lower down than it would be otherwise, and the air falls over, pushing the clouds to the side, so that you're able to see lower down to a lower atmospheric level, and then you see some different clouds, and maybe some different color. Okay. Except that, because you are traveling away from the equator, you're going north, and it's northern hemisphere, you're going south, it's the other hemisphere. As soon as this convecting air tries to fall over and fall back down, it has to move further away from the equator to do so. And as soon as it moves away from the equator, Coriolis takes what would have been a simple north-south motion, a simple motion along the meridian, and twists it around so that it's practically due east and due west. And that's the point of these arrows here. And so this is the effect that the rotation has on the appearance of the clouds, what would be blobs as convection clouds are on Earth. Cumulus clouds, the little fluffy, cottony clouds that you see over the fields on a warm summer afternoon, are caused by convection. If you look at a cumulus cloud, you'll see that it has a flat bottom, that is the surface where the temperature suddenly becomes such that water condenses. So nature is drawing for you on the sky a surface of constant temperature. You look at all those cumulus clouds, they all have flat bottoms, they're all the same height. Really neat, you know that that's happening. And then they have these puffy cloud tops, which are the top of the convection cell. And then the air turns around and falls back down again. One would be more or less circular features on Earth, because of this enormous rotation, this enormous Coriolis effect, are twisted out so that they go completely around the planet, around the equator. When you get up to intermediate latitudes, like where the great red spot and the long-lived ovals and the dark spots in the northern hemisphere are, then finally the strongest storm systems are able to maintain their individuality, although even those, I'm sure you notice, are elongated in east-west directions. As you go still further up towards the pole, then you get to that region where the striping is minor and where the cloud systems consist mainly of individual storm systems. I talked about Coriolis when I talked about the Hadley circulation on Venus, but I didn't use the word Coriolis. Remember when I explained Hadley circulation, I said the air would go from the equator up toward the pole, except that the planet's rotation twisted out into a spiral? Remember that? Coriolis that I had in mind there. Now, here is a remarkable observation that was made by Voyager 1. This is a plot of the east-west wind speed, zonal velocity in the meteorological term, meaning east-west wind speed, as opposed to north-south wind speed, which is meridional velocity. It is given in meters per second, and a meter per second to convert it to miles per hour multiplied by about 2.25. So 100 meters per second is about 237 miles per hour. And so you are getting up to nearly 300 miles an hour here from very strong winds. And they're plotted against latitude. There's the equator. There is about the latitude where we are here on the Earth. There's latitude 50 degrees north. Here's latitude 50 degrees south. And what is remarkable is that these Voyager 1 observations, all the dots which have been connected together by the blue colors as you see them, all of those wind currents were observable in that single rotation film in just a 10-hour period. Of course, you couldn't see it in the film. What they did was they took individual frames and painstakingly, laboriously measured exactly how fast the little cloud features were moving around. And, you know, this is what most of science consists of, these infinitely tedious measurements, which finally give you the spectacular results that people like me can present in five minutes. But from Earth, of course, the same sorts of observations have been made for decades. However, you can only see the very big spots from Earth. And so at a given latitude, you might have a spot, and then 10 years later, you have another spot. And only on those occasions can you measure the wind speed. You can't do it very, very often. This is a plot in which the Earth-based measurements made in a 5-year period here at New Mexico State University by a team under Rita Beebe, and she is one of the investigators on the Pioneer, on the Voyager imaging team as well. Their data has been plotted along with the Voyager data, and every single wind system that has been seen from Earth for 80 years is visible in these smaller spots on Jupiter in a period of 10 hours. In other words, there is incredible stability on Jupiter as far as the systems of wind, these very complex variations of first eastward, then westward, then eastward, then westward winds at various latitudes on the planet are. As a matter of fact, that is even more stable than the positions of the bright and dark spreads. So, in addition to explaining the variation in Jupiter, you've got to explain its remarkable stability. And the feeling after the pioneers was that Coriolis plus convection is sufficient to explain the Belden zone structure. The feeling after we've made this remarkable discovery is, there's more to it than that. There is something going on deeper in the atmosphere of Jupiter, something that is very unchangeable, something that makes these winds at every one of these latitudes very innate. And we've got to explain what that thing is. Can't tell you any more than that. I wish I could tell you what it is that's causing it, what is it going on. But there is something that's very innate. You notice also it's remarkably symmetrical around the equator. That's because in the movie your eye was your impression was really dominated by the global rotation of the whole planet. Remember, the strongest winds we've got on this diagram are about 300 miles an hour. The planet is going around at 22,000 miles an hour at the equator. And so your eye, in fact, if you look at the rotation movie very, very carefully, you can see the sort of faint crawling in a few places where one wind system is not moving as fast as another. But for exactly this reason, the Voyager people made another movie, which I'm going to show you in a little while. I've got to tell you some other things, give you some more background first, so you appreciate what you're seeing. I'm going to show you a movie in which they took a picture. They took actually three pictures, but this is going to be black and white. There's more detail visible. They took a picture every time a particular longitude of Jupiter was facing the camera, namely the longitude with the great red spot in it, okay? And they did that, a system three longitude. And they did that every Jupiter rotation for over an Earth month, and then put them all together as a time-lapse movie, in which effectively the rotation of the planet has been stopped. And you can see these wind systems go by, crawling past one another for a period of over an Earth month, and it is absolutely a fantastic film. So, stick around. That's a very, very good question, considering the constancy of these winds. It's got to be some sort of complex interplay between the underlying constancy that is represented, between whatever constant phenomenon in the lower atmosphere of the planet is represented by this constancy of the wind, versus the Coriolis effect. For example, suppose you have different amounts of convection at different times. Well, it's not really clear why you would. Remember, in Jupiter, the heat is not coming from the sun half a billion miles away. The heat is coming from inside the planet, for the most part. There's very little seasonal effect anyway. Jupiter has a pretty circular orbit, and it does not have a strong tilt of its axis to the orbit, which is what causes the seasons on the Earth. So it's not really obvious what would cause that. But it's true, the simplest facts of everyday meteorology on Earth are not true in Jupiter. It's no colder at night than it is in the daytime. It's no colder in winter than it is in summer. There's almost no seasonal effect anyway. And such as there is minimized by the fact that heat is coming from inside the planet. And above all, it's actually hotter at the poles than it is at the equator. Because of that equatorial flattening, the poles are closer to the center. Right? So they're closer to the heat source. They're in a hotter place. Here are two remarkable computer-generated pictures which were made by taking dozens and dozens of different Voyager pictures and taking the best parts in the central region of each one and plotting them on a Mercator projection map of Jupiter. This one was done for Voyager 1, and this one was done 4 months later for Voyager 2. And so what you've got there is the equator's running along like so, all the latitude lines would be parallel to the equator, and all the longitude lines would be perpendicular to that, and you're going from the equator to about 50 degrees north and about 60 degrees south, the reason for that being the Voyager 1 came in at a little bit of an angle, got a better view of the southern hemisphere. These have been set up so that the system 3 longitudes are the same, and so you can see how much the great red spot had moved in 4 months. I.e. not very much. But there is our friend DC at the time of Voyager 1. Here are the other two long lines oval. By the time of Voyager 2, DC has moved all the way over to there, and a completely different oval has happened to move into position where it was. Here you see, better than the picture I was able to show you before, the so-called barge features, which you see at this particular particular latitude, in the northern hemisphere. There are 12 of them all together in the Voyager 1 picture. I'm not sure they all show up in this reproduction. I made this fly over the weekend. I got it in at 4 o'clock this afternoon from the processor, and I observed that I overexposed it a bit over there, so then we lost some barges over there. But you can also see the plumes. There were 12 plumes there. I'm sorry, there were 12 plumes at the time of Voyager 1, 13 at the time of Voyager 2. And I just realized I forgot the number of barges. All right. We may be missing some barges over there anyway, though. And it's not obvious that any given plume in one of these pictures can be identified with the same plume in the other picture. They'll work on that, but it's not terribly obvious from just the comparison of them. Notice the change in appearance in 4 months of the region around the Great Red Spot. That turbulent region has gotten much more elongated, and the circulation over here to the right of the Red Spot has become quite different. And the Red Spot itself has become a little bit more prominent, a little bit, just a little bit different in shape and appearance. And you can do all kinds of such comparisons between these pictures, but we've got to move on. All right, here is a closer Voyager 1 view of that broad stripe. Remember, it's now broad in the northern hemisphere, this one here, this one here. And you can see that there is, especially near the center of that stripe, a good deal of blue in the picture. Now, this particular slide happens to be biased a little bit in the blue direction anyway, so it's just a little bit too good. But in fact, there is some real blue there. And again, the suspicion is this is a region where there's a hole or at least a thinning in the clouds, and we are seeing fairly deep into the atmosphere, but there happens not to be some brown cloud down there. Nevertheless, we are able to see into the atmosphere deeply enough that we get Rayleigh scattering. So you've got to realize, when you look at these pictures, it's tempting to think of this as a two-dimensional flat surface. It is not. You are seeing different clouds at different heights here. And you've got to remember that when you watch the clouds interact and try to understand how they interact with each other. There's a question about the belts and the zones relative to the wind system. If you remember that convection diagram that we talked about, this here would be one convection cell, okay? Coming up here, let me do it with my hand. Coming up here and going down here. The middle of the bright stripe, the middle of the zone, is the boundary. And you've got another one coming up here and going down there, okay? And then in addition, you have different wind systems. And typically, the boundary between the wind systems is the boundary between the dark and the bright stripe, especially in places where you see this kind of turbulence. It looks like turbulence, and it is turbulence, apparently. It's where one wind system is dragging atmosphere against another and distorting the clouds at the boundary. Here is a nice picture from Pioneer 11, the only spacecraft to have gotten up over the poles of Jupiter, which nicely illustrates how, as you go from the equator, there's that broad equatorial zone. Here's the plume region. Remember, we had a narrow stripe at that latitude in the northern hemisphere 5 years ago. And as you go from the equator up towards the pole, how the importance of the striping becomes less and less, and the importance of the ovals becomes greater and greater. There is one of the very finest Pioneer pictures. That's the Great Red Spot. What I'm going to do now is show you some pictures of the Great Red Spot. I've already told you most of what there is to say about it, but I want to show you the pictures. And here you can just get a hint of that anticyclonic circulation. There is yet another long-lived oval. I don't know which one that is. I think it's that big, but I don't want to swear to it. And there's a nice barge. And you just get a hint of the fact that you've got this circulation. Now, here, yeah. About 250 miles an hour. So it's strong, but it's about as strong as winds get on Jupiter. The question was, what's the speed of the winds in the hurricane? Other questions? If I'm going too fast, what's a plume? The structures that I talked about where, I guess this picture shows as well as any, where something comes up from under the clouds, erupts, and forms this plume that extends downwind. And you will see that happening very dramatically in this time-lapse movie I'm going to show you. One of them there? Great Red Spot from Voyager 1. I don't think it's fair. Well, the general feeling is that at least some of the brown is places where we're looking down into the atmosphere, but the barges are not the hot spots. The hot spots are those ones up in the northern hemisphere where you have the ring appearance. as though you have a convection cell and it's forming some sort of white cloud in the center, and then on the outside, as it fountains down around that central rising column, it's pushing the cloud aside and allowing you to see down something brown further down. The barges don't show that kind of structure. They show no hint of a white center, and in the infrared observations, they do not show abnormal heat. So I think I've got to say no, it has not been concluded so at all. Okay, I see a hand back there. That's dangerous. I almost never can see you. Just yell question or Jim or something. Coriolis? Okay. The effect of the rotation, Coriolis. That's why it becomes less and less parallel, why the stripes become less and less important, and the individual storm systems are able to assert themselves as individual objects instead of getting smeared completely around the planet. Let's put it this way. These stripes are what on Earth would be blob-shaped high or low pressure centers that have been taken by the rotation and smeared completely around the planet. Okay? That do a reasonable job of answering the question, or do you want more detail? Okay. That's a good question. How thick are these features we're looking at? I can tell you the great red spot is about 5 miles above everything around it. In most cases, we don't have much of a feeling for that. And it's not a simple question, because remember, different features are different heights here. For example, perhaps this is a hole, and we're looking down a few miles there. But you're not talking about hundreds of miles or thousands of miles. You're talking about miles, probably. This is still a thin, thin outer shell as far as the volume of the planet itself is concerned. And it's hard to understand how these features could maintain their integrity vertically, you know, otherwise. With the pressure gradient that you'd go through if you went down, say, 100 miles, I just can't imagine what would keep a cloud feature held together over that vertical height. But what's remarkable, when you look at a picture like this, is the way that they do maintain their integrity, and you'll see that even more spectacularly in the movie. A very common reaction to this picture particularly is it looks like colored oils on water. You notice that? In other words, it looks like immiscible fluids forming thin films. Immiscible means fluids that refuse to mix with one another the way you can dissolve, say, milk and water, but you cannot get vinegar and salad oil to mix together. In fact, it looks very much like the sort of thing, you know, that you can get by pouring out some vinegar and salad oil in your salad plate and taking a fork and smearing it around a bit. You get this kind of structure. Well, what is even more remarkable, as you see in the film, is it happens that up there is a westward wind current until you get down under the Great Red Spot, where it gets really, really complex, really important. Down there, there's an eastward one, and you will see these blobs like that one. This one has been caught in the act. This is one of the many frames in the film. You will see these blobs move along, get caught in the circulation around the Great Red Spot, get sucked into it, and move around. Sometimes they get kicked out when they get down there. Sometimes they move around here, get kicked out like so. Sometimes they swing round and round and round around the Great Red Spot. We watch one of them do it for 10 complete cycles over the period of several weeks. And they get distorted, they get squeezed, they get broken in half, very occasionally they merge, but they absolutely refuse to give up their identity and simply mix them with the stuff around them. And you'd think they would have. These are not immiscible fluids. These are gases. Okay, it's not gases you're seeing. The gases are rendered visible by cloud particles, but it is the gas motion that is causing the clouds to move, and gases are never immiscible. They cannot be because there is space between their atoms and molecules. And so if we were to take a bottle of perfume and break it in one corner of this room, everybody knows that within a few minutes, you'd have the uniform smell of the perfume. In other words, the gas would be uniformly distributed through the whole room. Gases mix with one another. How do you manage, especially since these features are at different heights, to have this remarkable appearance of immiscible fluid and this remarkable insistence of these features on maintaining their integrity? That is one of the biggest mysteries that Voyager 1 has presented to us, and we do not know the answer. At the very, very finest level, this looks very detailed, but believe me, that's 2.5 times the size of the Earth. You can have much more detail than that. The very closest pictures that Voyager 1 took, and Voyager 1 is irrelevant in here because it went much closer to Jupiter than Voyager 2 did. The very closest pictures are featureless. At the very closest view, you do see blurring of those edges. But only at the very, very closest. Only when you get down to where you are seeing things that's a few miles across. I thought I saw a hand silhouetted back there, yeah. That's a wonderful question. Why does this appear to abandon? Apparently because it is a strong enough storm that it's able to maintain its integrity and keep itself together. You know, and remember, it is far enough from the equator that it's not getting the very worst of the Coriolis. Up at the equator, we saw nothing that looked like a spot. Down here at this latitude, we're beginning to see even the very strongest one, and still farther from the equator, as I showed you in that Pioneer 11 picture, you see even smaller. But presumably because it's big enough, it's able to keep itself together. But you notice even the Great Red Spot has been stretched each way, and so has these ovals. Well, it stayed almost the same. It changes its size a little bit, it changes color, sometimes it goes away, apparently because it's covered over by a layer of white clouds. So you see, I told you this is the highest cloud, and then I told you the white clouds are the next highest, but it's not that simple. Sometimes anyway, it's not that simple. And there may be different kinds of white clouds here. There are at least three different substances that can form clouds in Jupiter's atmosphere, all of which, if they're not colored, namely ammonia, ammonium hydrosulfide, and water, all of which, if they're not colored by some impurity, as you see some of the clouds are and some are not, are white. So it's not obvious that white cloud there is at the same height as and made of the same stuff as that white cloud there or that white cloud there, for example. But it stays. When it disappears, it always comes back, and there's always this hollow in the stripe that it occupies to tell us where it was. It's not anchored to anything, though. It moves around the planet in longitude. There is no rotation period you can dream up that'll make a Great Red Spot remain stationary. That's a good question. Nobody knows. It's the only one that doesn't die out. You notice it's the biggest one. That may be related. In fact, there's some theoretical reason to believe the bigger they are, the harder it is to kill them, just because they have so much more energy. But let me point out something, too. Remember, the whole interior of that planet is liquid. A hurricane on Earth does not die out as long as it's still over the ocean. It only dies out when it comes on land and doesn't have the water coming up from below it to evaporate and condense and form clouds and release heat and keep it going. That analogy may be semi-applicable. It's not completely applicable because you don't have the same liquid here coming up and condensing and forming clouds, but it may still have a germ of relevance in it. Question back there? Yeah, Galileo is going, which will be launched originally in 1982. We're having enough trouble with the shuttle that that may not be possible. But in any case, two spacecraft launched, maybe separately now, those will arrive in 1985. One of them will go into orbit around Jupiter, and the other will be a probe, a single probe, not like Venus where you had four, which will go in at the equator. That's a white region, so we think all the cloud levels that exist on Jupiter are represented there, because the highest one is represented there, and transmit data as long as it can survive the pressure. It'll be the pressure that gets it, and it'll die at a pressure of around 10 to 20 Earth atmospheres and about room temperature. The problem with Galileo probe is not surviving after you've re-entered. It's a relatively benign environment compared to Venus after you've entered. The problem is you hit the atmosphere at 54 kilometers a second. That'd be about 30 miles a second. No, because Jupiter's gravity is so strong. And the problem is surviving that entry. So half the weight of the probe is each year. Yeah, question next. Uh-oh, this is the kind I always worry about. Go ahead. See, now when I can't answer this, I look so stupid. Yeah, it has. We think the reason that Io has the colors that it has is sulfur and sulfur compounds, and that sort of thing has been invoked as a possibility. So, no, not that it's a satellite forming. Actually, that when the Great Red Spot was first sort of rediscovered by astronomers around 1910, it had been there all along in the literature, but they hadn't been paying attention. And, you know, it was really drawing people's attention in 1910. It was actually suggested that it happened to be a period when the Great Red Spot was reappearing after one of those temporary times it was hiding. It was actually suggested we were seeing the birth of a new satellite. But, no, it's not. It's a hurricane. I mean, you can see that by watching the circulation in the movie. It's a meteorological feature. But it may be that the same substances which color Io are involved in the coloration of the Great Red Spot. That is a very good possibility. Sulfur and its compounds can produce a huge variety of shades of reds and yellows and all going in a separate stream. You can't see the boundaries between the different wind streams in these
still pictures, obviously. In the movie, I think it'll be quite obvious. Let me show you a few more Red Spot pictures and then get to the movie. Just moving in closer and closer, basically. Wonderful view of DC there. This stuff is deep as inside. It's got to be one of the most fantastic pictures in the history of the space program from here. This is the one that was drawing me, oh, a bunch of people in many places, but it's drawing the magazine, Woodstock Palace, and so on. And it's just, you know, it's just, I mean, I talk science, but I hope that doesn't mean I don't have a soul, you know, and just looking at this as a work of abstract art is worth taking a few moments to do. Carl Sagan says, everybody's first reaction to this picture is, that looks like a painting by, and I can't think of who it is. You know, Jupiter apparently has a style of its own. Now, you got to understand that although these color pictures are very pretty, they are made from individual black and white pictures which were taken a minimum of 48 seconds apart. And during that time, the spacecraft moved a little bit, and the planet rotated a little bit, and the weather changed a little bit. So the very sharpest pictures are the individual black and white images of which they're made up. For example, this mosaic, it's also easier to exaggerate the contrast in black and white. This mosaic of the Great Red Spot, this is in blue light, this is through the blue filter, and the reason for that is that since the red spot is red, it shows the greatest amount of contrast in the opposite end of the spectrum, namely blue. Now, what I'm going to show you at this point, this movie that I've been promising you, the time-lapse film, there is so much that happens during it, and it's only a few seconds, even though this is over a month's worth, because they can only take a frame every 10 hours. So there is so much that happens during it that there is no way you're going to be able to take it all in one view. What I'm going to do is ask the projectionist to stop it every once in a while, stop it after each run-through, turn around and run through it backwards, and then turn around and run through it forwards again, go through it a number of separate times, and you'll be able to look at different things each time, and after a while you'll get the general idea. This particular movie is black and white, not color, and I picked that because you do get more detail in black and white. I suggest that you not look particularly at the Great Red Spot in the first sequence. And the reason is the first two sequences, first slow and then fast, show the whole planet. Afterwards, we have the same two sequences, first slow and then fast, enlarged to show the region around the red spot itself. It's the same pictures. It's not taken any closer, but it's enlarged so you can see the detail better. So I suggest you spend pay most of your attention to the areas other than the Great Red Spot in the whole planet sequences that begin. This film was made from the blue images, and so this is the one that is familiarly referred to by the Voyager scientists as the blue movie. So, we have the slides off and the blue movie on. Focus that a little better. That's good. Going out of focus again. These dots and flashes you see occasionally are satellites and their shadows. Now watch, for example, the relative motion of the plumes up here and the turbulence happening. And you can see the turbulence in the southern hemisphere around the Great Red Spot becoming very complex just downstream of it. Notice BC moving slowly past the Red Spot. Plumes moving very rapidly. That's one of the strongest jets on the planet. Okay, now we'll run through the speeded up version. And the term weather machine, I think, will take on a whole new meaning for you. We turn around, move that, and go backwards through that. Now, just the fast sequence. It's the motions of the long of those rings, which are on the boundary. Now, forward again, please. Those rings are on, those hot spots are on the boundary between two wind regimes. See what I mean? Now backward again. And forward one more time. Well, they're not moving as fast as some other things, but they are moving. Notice. They started out down there. Okay, now we'll show you the enlarged region around the Great Red Spot. Can you focus that a little better? I don't know why the focus keeps changing on this, but it's very critical on these movie projectors. Okay, now you'll be able to see these spots moving in, getting sucked into circulation. Here comes the first one. That was a yell. Now, if it's split in half, one part goes that way, the other part goes rapidly around. Here comes another spot. Right about there was where we saw it in that first color picture that I showed you. And it gets split apart also, and part of it regenerates, moves around there. Now, here comes the speeded up version of the same thing. Want to turn around and go backwards? Forward, please. I'm not sure what they expected. Why don't you go backward and then forward one more time? I'm not sure you can say they expected much of anything. I can tell you this, a major surprise in Voyager 1 was the amount of this circulatory motion there is. We knew you had it in the Great Red Spot. What was not at all clear was that you had it in all those other little ovals too. And that was very surprising. So in that sense, the answer is no. Well, the reason there's no heavy circulation in Jupiter is basically the same as you have almost none on Earth. The rotation is even worse. See, and there is just, it would take so much velocity change to go from the equator up to the pole that you just don't have it. In a sense, they had the circulation that you have from the equator up to, you know, whatever is the edge of the convection cell that is closest to it. That one little thing there, twisted out by Coriolis, that is a Hadley cell. And then you've got another Hadley cell, and then another Hadley cell, another Hadley cell all the way up to the pole. So in a sense, you've sort of got it there. But the Hadley cells are broken up, especially in the regions where you have the ovals, in the same way as that in middle latitudes of Earth. The Hadley circulation disappears, and you have the Rossby wave circulation across us instead. That means that the smooth flow is broken up into blobs at the surface. They correspond to waves further up in the atmosphere, which are our high and low pressure systems. Okay, I've got two more pictures of the Great Red Spot. Here is the closest one that I'm going to show you. I think you can begin to see that we got much closer. We begin to run out of detail. And it inserted at the impression there's some white clouds beginning to move in. But the next picture is going, this is more or less normal color. Color a little bit exaggerated, but not very much. The next picture that I'm going to show you is very exaggerated color in which the dominant red has been mostly suppressed by the computer, and what small differences in color are left over have been exaggerated. And so you get something that's very, very colorful, but it's not real. I mean, it's not real in the sense that these colors are not this intense. They're there. They've just been exaggerated so you can see them. And here it is. And I think you can see here that this is an invading cloud layer because you can see that spiral structure coming in under it. See? Visible dimly under it. By the way, something else. You're asking me about why BC didn't get sucked into the red spot. Did you notice that even the closer ovals, the ones that went around there, never got sucked into the red spot? They got sucked into the circulation around it. But something that's a little remarkable is they never went inside. And we're not quite sure what to make of that. It may be that simple words like hurricane are not the whole story. Well, you can certainly see, I guess from the earlier pictures better. There's a good one. I can never find it again. There we go. I mean, there's no question but what you're seeing is spiral there, right? It doesn't seem to go all the way to the center, though. In the center, you have this irregular region. The red spot is higher than the clouds around it, with the exception of, apparently, this one invading white layer. But it's certainly colder than almost anything else on the planet. About 15 degrees colder. So it's about 5 miles higher, we think. 15 degrees Fahrenheit, that was. Right, by temperature. That's right. That's right. Okay, here is the interior structure of Jupiter from the Pioneer 10 and 11 model. The way you obtain this structure, I think I talked about this, didn't I? That you fly to the spacecraft past the planet and measure its trajectory very accurately. I went through that, right? First week? No? I'm not sure I did. All right. You fly the spacecraft past the planet, and yeah, I did. I remember saying this because I was talking about... No, I'm sorry, different lecture. All right. You can track the position of the spacecraft very, very accurately because it has a gadget on it called a transponder. And the transponder is simply something that you send out a beep, and the beep goes out, you know, on radio, okay, radio signal, very short radio signal. It goes out, gets picked up by the spacecraft, and immediately sent right back to you. So you measure the travel time that it takes for the radio signal to go out and back. And that gives you the distance very, very accurately, because we know the speed at which radio waves travel. They travel at the speed of light, and we know the speed of light very, very accurately, 186,282.3960 miles per second. And so you can measure the distance of the spacecraft about half a billion miles away, or in the case of Pioneer 11, a billion miles away at Saturn, with an error of 3 feet. And that means that you can measure very tiny deviations from the trajectory that you would get if the planet were perfectly spherical and perfectly homogeneous and perfectly this, that, and the other thing, and figure out the distribution of materials inside it by how dense they all are. From their densities, you can get the pressure. From the densities, you can get the pressure, and from the pressure, you can get the temperature at each level inside, because you know that the hotter it is, the more expanded it is in any given level. So this is the picture that we have of the interior structure of Jupiter. The atmosphere, this caption says 82% hydrogen, 17% helium. Those are not the numbers I gave you. And the reason is I gave you in terms of number of atoms. This is weight percentage. A helium atom weighs 4 times as much as a hydrogen atom. So naturally, the weight percentage of helium is greater than the percentage of number of atoms of helium. 1% other elements. Cloud tops are 150 miles down. Down from what? I mean, what reference level can you use except the cloud top? Well, they've picked some pressure, and they decided to say, okay, that's the level where the pressure is, that particular amount is zero. And I don't know what the pressure is, but the point is to track 150 miles from all these other numbers that you want to get below cloud top. Transition, please notice, from gas to liquid hydrogen about 600 miles down. Did I tell you 1,000 miles? I'm sorry, I meant 1,000 kilometers. Transition to liquid metallic hydrogen is 15,000 miles down, temperature already tens of thousands of degrees, pressure about 3 million Earth atmospheres. That's what determines the transition, the pressure. We don't know the pressure too well. We can't create this stuff in the laboratory. We can't get that kind of pressure. But the theory is that it's somewhere around 3 million Earth atmospheres. If you want to say a somewhat different number, nobody will argue with you too much. Probably a small core about the size of the Earth, but about 3 times as heavy as the Earth because it's been compressed so much by the weight of the overlying material, but so hot, 54,000 degrees Fahrenheit at the center, that it would be molten anyway. And you see that most of the planet is this big ball of liquid metallic hydrogen. Okay, this I've already told you most about. Here is the structure of the atmosphere. We have altitude above yet some other arbitrary level in kilometers. 0 to 160 kilometers is 100 miles. This curve gives you the temperature at each altitude in degrees Fahrenheit. Why did I use that there? English there is beyond me. And this is the pressure in Earth atmosphere. So there's where the level is the same as in this room. And you see the temperature at that level is about 150 below 0 Fahrenheit. And you can see also the pressure increases rapidly as you go down. Here is the height, roughly the height, somewhere between there and a bit further down, where Galileo probe will be destroyed. And you see two of the three layers of clouds that I promised you. I don't know what happened with this slide, but for some reason the symbol for the frozen water clouds hasn't come out, and also there should be a liquid water cloud still further down. Now, here's the picture in which lightning was discovered. First photograph of lightning ever seen on another planet, although by then we had the Pioneer Venus and Venera lander observations of lightning from the electrical signals. These are the first photographs of lightning ever taken on another planet. What you're seeing here is a picture that was taken entirely while Voyager 1 was on the night side of Jupiter, was in the shadow of Jupiter. So if you look back toward the edge of the planet, which is here, if we have the whole planet pictured, this enormous circle that goes way outside the screen. The reason you can see the edge is that there is also the first aurora ever photographed on another planet. Aurora is northern lights, so-called, although you have in the southern hemisphere as well. And that entire aurora, which is the brightest we ever get on Earth, it's at least 20,000 miles long. There's 20,000 miles worth of the edge of the planet there in the picture. And that entire thing had come into existence during the previous 90 seconds. 90 seconds before this, another picture was taken, no aurora is visible. And you can see, as these dots here, 17 lightning flashes. The reason that the picture is so grainy is that this is a fairly long time exposure, several minutes, and the planet was deep within the radiation belt, the trapped protons and electrons for the most part, which are trapped around Jupiter by Jupiter's magnetic field. And those pass through the spacecraft. Voyager 1 absorbed a total radiation dosage about 1,000 times the amount necessary to kill an unprotected human. Pioneer 10, which had gone closer, absorbed 3,000 times as much. All the big moons of Jupiter are deep within the radiation belt, so it's going to be a long time before we see human expeditions out to Jupiter. And the charge built up on the inside of the television camera was read out as over an image, so it's a very grainy picture. There are, in fact, improved versions of this picture since, but I like this one just because it's so dramatic, it so dramatically illustrates the conditions under which it was taken. The lightning bolts are described as intense as the most intense that we ever get on the Earth. But that is misleading, because you've never seen one of those. The most intense lightning bolts we ever get on Earth were only discovered 2 years ago from photographs taken of our planet from space by weather satellites. They are called super bolts, and they occur only at the tops of thunderstorms, and then only in the tropics. So a better way to describe this is these are 100 times as strong as the most intense lightning bolts you've ever seen from the ground in temperate latitudes on the Earth. Of course, as soon as we discovered lightning on Jupiter, a lot of us got very excited because here seems to be a huge natural Miller-Urey experiment going on. And so as soon as they were discovered, I phoned some biochemists at Ames Research Center. I was at JPL when these pictures were taken, but they have a nice little thing called the Federal Telephone System whereby you can make these calls for free. So I phoned a bunch of biochemists and interviewed them for the report I did on the lightning on National Public Radio and said, do you think this means there's life in Jupiter? First guy that I talked to, Sherwood Chang, as soon as I told him about the lightning, he hadn't heard about it, of course, it had only been announced a few hours earlier, as soon as I told him, he got very excited. I thought, all right, I got a story, you know, I got a scoop here, because I figured most of the other reporters wouldn't have thought of the light connection, you know, yet. Anyway, they would have just thought of a report of the lightning. I wanted to be able to say something intelligent and different. And so I got very excited, and I was real happy about this, and I said, do you think that means there's life in Jupiter? He said, no, come on. He was excited because it means there are going to be some organic chemicals created by these, and that's what he's interested in. He doesn't care if they're alive or not. And probably it does mean there is more complex organic chemistry trace substances in the atmosphere, but it doesn't seem likely that this means life for two reasons. I should back up a bit. You realize when I talk about life in Jupiter, it's not a ridiculous idea. There's no solid surface. But the atmosphere gets dense enough that you could imagine things swimming around in it at just about the altitude level where the temperature becomes more or less room temperature, Earth surface kind of temperature. So, you know, you could eat. Most life on the Earth is and always has been swimming around in a fluid, right? The ocean. Land life is a recent development in evolution, which may or may not succeed, but normally life in the ocean life on the Earth is ocean life. You know, you've got all that methane, ammonia, and water vapor, just as Miller and Urey had, and now you've got the lightning. But what Miller and Urey did not have in their flask, because they were not trying to duplicate the Jupiter atmosphere, they were trying to duplicate what they thought was the early Earth atmosphere, what they didn't have in their flask was all that hydrogen. And the hydrogen has the effect of chemically attacking. When you do Miller-Urey type of experiments with a Jupiter-type atmosphere, the hydrogen has the effect of chemically attacking complex organics and reducing them, breaking them down into simpler ones, small fragments. That's one problem. The other problem is there is so much convection, so much vertical motion all over the atmosphere, even the polar regions. After the pioneers, we thought there wasn't much in the polar regions. Now the Voyager's better picture shows there's a lot there as well. That if organics did form at reasonable kinds of temperatures, almost certainly the convection would be enough to carry them down where it's lower and hotter and destroy them because of the temperature. So the general feeling among most, though not all, biochemists is probably Jupiter is just not a good place to look for life. The reason I said most but not all is there are always some who point out, listen, we don't know everything there is to know about biochemistry by any means. For one thing, it's not at all certain that Jupiter has always been the way it is now, you know. I mean, we're just seeing it at one moment in geologic time. And it's conceivable that at some earlier time when Jupiter was different, at least as far as the convection is concerned, you still got the hydrogen problem, but it's possible that life could have developed there and then evolved as Jupiter changed and developed defense mechanisms so that it doesn't have this sort of problem. There are undersea organisms like, for example, whales you know, which go from the surface all the way down to the bottom. It's enormous pressure differential from the top to the bottom. They go down there and they hunt giant squid. And, you know, it seems very hard to imagine how that could have happened, and yet it at the beginning, when the life was just getting underway, but after it gets underway, it can evolve and it can fill in all these strange niches. So it's not impossible that there is life in Jupiter. Notice you don't say on. These planets are so different from the Earth, you even change your preposition. Life in Jupiter, swimming around in the atmosphere of Jupiter. And if not Jupiter, remember you got three other Jovian planets to play with, each of which is different from Jupiter. You got Saturn, where the Pioneer 11 pictures show there is much, much less meteorological activity going on in the atmosphere, much quieter atmosphere than you have in Jupiter, and you have virtually unknown Uranus and Neptune as well. So the whole question about life in the solar system is by no means concluded. That doesn't mean that I'm saying I think there is life out there. I'm saying there is still a possibility. It's still a fairly good possibility. But Jupiter, current Jupiter, at least as far as simple life getting started is concerned, probably not. Well, what else would produce that bright a flash, and so many of them? I guess that's the best answer to that question. And also, we know because it produces radio waves, which were the spherics, remember, which were the way we discovered it in Venus, and those are produced by this stuff as well in Jupiter. Jupiter has an awfully nice ring to it. That was discovered by Voyager 1. Since we are virtually out of time, I'm going to skip over the discovery pictures. As you see, it's a bunch of edge-on images of the ring, and the reason it's a bunch is the spacecraft is moving a little bit during a very, very long time exposure. If I told you this is a lightning picture, you probably wouldn't believe it, but those are stars. And they're trailed because of the motion. Very little motion. Remember how powerful that camera is. The ring is very different from Saturn. It is much, much less dense. Here is a Voyager 2 picture of it on the way in. A lot of noise. That's not real. But the artist has drawn there where the rest of the ring is so you can see, you know, what these two little lines are. But it turns out that although it's very faint, much less dense than Saturn, not made of bright particles such as Saturn's rings are, they're made of ice, or at least rock is covered by ice, it's a very different kind of ring. There's only one ring for one thing. But it turns out when you get around behind Jupiter that it becomes very, very bright. And the reason is that there are particles within the ring that are about the size of the wavelength of light, and very strongly shoot light forward when you get around so that you're in the direction almost opposite the sun. Okay, in other words, when the ring particles are backlighted. Nobody really knew that was going to happen, and so these pictures were a very great surprise. This is taken by Voyager 2, and the pictures were taken originally to try to get some more lightning. And there may very well be some lightning buried in there, but at this particular reproduction, what you see is light bent around by dust particles in the atmosphere of Jupiter doing the same thing, and then the ring. And there is the ring. You see it instantly disappears when you get to the edge of the planet, because it's in the planet's shadow there. And the planet is also casting a shadow onto the ring, which happens to be, light happens to be from the bottom, okay? And that's how the sunlight through the atmosphere is stronger around the bottom, so the shadow is up in the top part of the ring. Notice particularly, over here in this picture, which is closer, a little bit longer, there is material interior to the main ring. As a matter of fact, shame that one got smeared by spacecraft motion, you can see the rest. That material apparently came all the way into the planet. Now, I got to cut off at this point. I'm 2 minutes over. I realize that not everything I said here about rings is going to be all that obvious, but one thing I keep talking about, particles. You may not realize that the rings are not solid plates. There are many, many small particles in orbit around the planet. Naturally, when I talk about Saturn 2 weeks from now, I will go into planetary rings in much more detail. So if you can postpone your understanding of rings for a couple of weeks, I just wanted to make sure you had these pictures under your belt before you left, but I will say much more about planetary rings when we discuss Saturn. For now, though, thank you very much, and hope to see you next week. Of course, we've got a few minutes. We've got to be out of here in 7 minutes. So we've got 7 minutes in which we can still ask some questions. So those who want to leave can do so, and we'll give them a minute or so. And then if you want to ask some questions, that's great.
What's the significance of blue coloration?
What blue coloration? Oh, Rayleigh scattering, probably. Probably that is not some blue substance.
What?
In the case of the red and the orange, we think it's a red and orange substance. In the case of the blue, it's always fuzzy. You don't see well-defined regions of blue. And so probably it's Rayleigh scattering, i.e. deep atmosphere.
How close to the ring?
Yeah. Well, you saw that picture there, and of course it was the scale, and the diameter of Jupiter is 86,500 miles, so I don't remember the number offhand, but they are within the Rose limit, yes, and so are the rings of Uranus. But one of the rings of Saturn that's
this is the test, over
and
out.
Way outside the Rose limit.
Beyond
five of the moons, as you go out through the moon, the ones that may or may not exist just outside the ring, at least one does, Pioneer 11 photographed. Then you have Mimas and Fellas, Tethys, and Ellie and Rhea, fairly close together. You got a big gap before you can find them. They're asteroid belts.